So this evening, what I would like to reflect on are the ways that the Buddha spoke about this idea of self. It's quite a predominant and central idea in our life. And as I reflect on this or speak about this, I really invite you to pay attention to how you listen and how you receive this material. Because clearly I always think of Dharma talks as a participatory exercise, that it takes as much effort to listen well as it does to speak. And it's being aware of, as we listen, we're actually looking at how we digest this teaching. You know, does it just sound like a good idea? Or does it sound like it's a good idea for somebody else? Or do we look at it and sense, well, how does this sit with my own thinking and my own views and my own conclusions? And I feel quite confident when the Buddha taught, and I think this is a tradition well worth continuing, that exploring the Dharma is always a joint investigation. It's always a process of investigating, how does this look in my own experience? You know, how does this apply to me? And what are the implications of this in my own life? So let's go back to three of the kind of very core teachings of the Buddha. He said it very simply, that all conditioned phenomena are dukkha, innately unable to provide lasting happiness and freedom. He said all conditioned phenomena are anicca, that the ripples of ever-present change and instability run through all events, all life, all experience. And he says that all conditioned phenomena are anatta, empty of self, that there is no eternal center, no independent self-existence. And the teaching of anatta, or non-self, and the teaching of sunya, or sunyata, or emptiness, are probably the most radical of all of the Buddha's teaching. And you have to really just try to imagine how it was 2,600 years ago in India, where the Buddha taught. And he lived in a time and in a cultural and a spiritual ethos where all around him what he saw were people engaged in heroic and endless quests to secure a present and a future self. And the ways that that was done in primarily in India at that time is through my understanding, a way that the present and future self was secured was through ritual, through identity, through roles, through accumulation of merit, through sacrifice. And the Buddha invited those around him, those who were interested, to investigate the whole notion of a self being central to all experience and present in all things. And in that time, I think it was radical, because any teaching that invites us to challenge our self-view and our view of the world is radical. Now, it is easy to think of this questioning or the radical nature of this being somehow time located, you know, particularly relevant to 2,600 years ago in India, but I don't think it's so. I think in our times, in our worlds, you know, the preservation of a present and future self is a pretty dedicated pursuit, isn't it? I mean, we do it in kind of slightly different ways, but we see the way that we rely upon possessions, what we gain and what we have in order to be a self. We see how perhaps we seek for forms of identity through roles, through relationships, through positions, through stature, to try to secure a present and an unassailable self. And, you know, perhaps deep in our hearts, we find ourselves just a little bit hoping or a little bit craving for the continuity of me. You know, I recently came across a young person wearing a T-shirt, and the slogan on the T-shirt said, "Actually, it is all about me." And I thought, terrific, finally somebody's honest enough to say it, you know, or even to put it on their T-shirt. So, you know, we have to think, consider, what are our emotional responses to the proposal that the sense of I, the solidity of me, may be no more than a view? It's an interesting one. It may be no more than a view. An illusion. It's like a mirage in a desert, or the illusion that because we see the sun go rise in one direction and seemingly go down in another direction, it seems to make perfect sense, doesn't it, that the sun is circling the earth and the earth is in the center. But we know that's not true. But the intellectual knowing of that truth doesn't quite match up with our perceptions. So what is our response to the possibility that it's actually not all about me? That there are bodies, emotions, perceptions, intentions, the mind that we all experience moment to moment, they're actually not mine, they don't belong to me, and they're not who I am. Now, it's interesting to see, just have a felt sense of what our reactions are to this, not just as an intellectual exercise. Do we find ourselves being dismissive? Kind of feeling with that little voice inside, you know, that says, well, of course, that's a fine idea, but really I am. You know, really I am. I think, you know, therefore I am. I have my life. I have my story. When we hear the possibility that this is all, I'm actually a view of self, or do we find ourselves disturbed? You know, do we wonder who I am, what would get me out of bed in the morning? Do we say, but look at all that I've done, look at all that I've dreamed, look at all that I long for and wish to do? Do we feel agitated as if it's somehow a theft of something? You know, a kind of theft of my story. You know, what about my hopes, my dreams, my individuality? You know, do we actually hear it sometimes as rather frightening? And certainly I see this when people deepen in meditative practice and some of the solidity begins to soften. I think of it as a kind of vertigo of non-self. You know, that sense that when that solidity seems to dissolve inwardly, the ground doesn't look so steady. You know, in this initial period of this kind of vertigo of non-self. Or do we hear this possibility that everything's not as fixed and solid as it seems as a kind of good news? Because, you know, we might actually appreciate, some of us by this time in our lives, that it's really hard work to be a self. Mm-hmm. You know, that the endless busyness of protecting and asserting and proving and feeling that we have to make ourself look very meaningful. And, you know, it's sometimes we're just tired of the story of me. People found that I was so tired of the story of me. You know, it's so repetitive, you know. It just goes round and round and round. That same old story of me, you know, the chattering me. So I think it's very important to examine this whole domain very clearly because, you know, the self is a very felt experience. The sense of self is a very felt experience. And I think this is one of the primary reasons why the teaching of non-self can feel so unpalatable or implausible. It's like you wake up in the morning and you find yourself waiting for you, don't you? It's kind of like a comfy or familiar pair of slippers just sitting there beside your bed, and you just kind of slip into myself, you know, and I'm just ready to get on with my day. And this is okay. This is okay because the Buddha did not teach no self. No self would make us dysfunctional, and everything we hear is that the Buddha and the disciples around him were really quite functional people. No self would make us dysfunctional. It's actually good news to know my address. You know, it's good news to know my house. And actually, you know, that I get into my car rather than yours, you know, and that I get into the right bed with the right person. I mean, this is all very good news, you know, that I know who my children are, you know, and I don't mistake them for yours. This is all good news. This is what I call navigational self. It's navigational self. It's just purely conventional. It just helps us to get through our day in a very, very practical way. So when the Buddha taught non-self, he said that there is no thing that has an independent self-existence. And he taught the ways to bring clinging to a view of self to an end. And the Buddha actually described the view of self. Actually, he used some quite strong words about it. He says, it's an irritation. He said, it's an illness. It's a vexation. It's a fabrication. And that it's an error of grammar. It's a grammatical error. So he proposed that the majority of the difficulties that we experience in our lives, the fears, the struggles, the conflicts, the confusions, propose that the majority of our psychological and emotional suffering stems from reifying the notion and centralizing the view of self. And he proposed that the release of this view, the end of clinging to this view, is what will open the door to a very profound sense of peace and freedom and bring fear and conflict to an end. And that the ending of that identification with a view of self, its outcome is an unshakable kindness, compassion, equanimity, and a life imbued with joy. Look about unbinding the heart. Unbinding the heart. I'd like to read you a poem from the Buddha. Not a poem, he wasn't really a poet. A few lines from the Buddha's teaching. He said, through many lives I sought in vain the builder of this house of pain. Now, builder, thee I plainly see, this is the last abode for me. The gables, yoke, and rafters dissolved, my heart, rafters broke, my heart has peace. My heart has peace. Now, the Buddha described this as liberation. The ending of house building. This is not a particularly, I must say, particularly uniquely a Buddhist idea. I'd like to share with something from you by a neuropsychologist called Paul Brocks, who's actually spent his entire professional life trying to find the self in his patients and eventually in himself. He says, the illusion is irresistible. Behind every face, there is a self. We imagine an essence, but what do we find in that space behind the face when we look? He said, one might think that the self is divided in such circumstances, but this would be to swallow the illusion of unity. To imagine in the first place there is some whole thing to be fractionated. There isn't. He says, there is no special point of convergence in the different zones of the brain, no cockpit of the soul, no soul pilot. They come together in a work of fiction. A human being is a storytelling machine. The self is a story. This is not to say that our lives are fictions. Unlike Robinson Crusoe or Emma Bovary, we are embedded in a universe with physical and moral dimensions, where every thought and action splinters into a million consequences. He goes on to say, who tells the story of the self? That's like asking who thunders the thunder or rains the rain. It's not so much a question of us telling the story as the story telling us. And I think this is really such an important reflection. The way that our sense of self, the stories we tell that are told inwardly, are constantly presenting us with the view of who we are moment to moment. Now, I find a curious thing in teaching, you know, over many years, and by the way, I haven't been teaching retreats since 1967. I think that was a misprint. I would have been 15. And it was a little older than that. It was 74, which sounds a little bit more reasonable. But I have noticed over many years of teaching that there's a tendency to reserve the talk of anatta or non-self almost for the last evening of a retreat, as if this is such a complex teaching that we have to prepare for it. And, you know, on some level, that is true. Because I think for us to undertake any kind of meaningful investigation of any kind requires some depth of calm, some depth of mindfulness, some curiosity and inner stillness. And also when we hear the words anatta or non-self or emptiness, that's even a bigger word, isn't it? Or voidness. They feel like such big and weighty words. But it's also important to acknowledge that the Buddha did not reserve these teachings for graduate students, and in fact encouraged us not to be intimidated by the words, and that this is an understanding accessible to us all, and that the freedom and the peace offered by this understanding is also accessible to all. And I would suggest that in truth, everything we do in this practice, everything we do in this path, is really dedicated to the process of emptying all moments, all events, and all experiences of selfing. We're learning to empty all moments, all events and experiences of clinging and reification. And this engagement in the practice of emptying, of course, can only be cultivated in the moment that we're present in. Because this can never, if it's going to make any difference, only be a conceptual understanding. It's an applied understanding. Personally, I really like this metaphor of house building. I think it's something so traceable, so trackable, so accessible as a metaphor that we can actually see in our own experience. the view of self, the house builder, the ways that we can go through our day seeking to establish an abode. You know, abode usually defined by clinging, an abode of some solidity and safety. So the primary mechanism that is used to establish our house or build our house or establish an abode moment to moment, the primary mechanism that is used to do that is not wooden nails, it's clinging and identification. It creates the abode in which we can give language to that abode by saying, I am, or this is me, or this belongs to me. Now, this process of house building, I think, is easily traceable in our own experience if we look clearly. I often think of this, you know, when I travel quite a bit, and particularly if I'm a bit disoriented by jet lag, I'm always so curious about those moments when I wake up in the morning in an unfamiliar bed and in an unfamiliar place. And I'm sure many of you have had this experience. And for a moment, you just don't know where you are. But it's bigger than that, because it seems that if you don't have those bearings, it's not so easy to know who you are. You know, there's this sense of this kind of universe that hasn't quite knitted itself together in some sort of solid way. You know, and when I first had those experiences, I would find myself a bit sort of anxious to kind of pin it all down, you know, turn on the light, try and remember where I am, what I'm doing. But now I find I'm really quite fond of those moments. And you just sort of let the universe be a little bit discontinuous for a while, because clinging hasn't quite crept in. You know, and then perhaps it changes, you know, and I start to identify the familiar furniture, and I know it's this kind of hotel, or the color of the blinds, and I know it's this kind of room, and then I sort of remember where I am, and then I sort of remember who I am, and then I sort of remember I have a purpose there. And suddenly the universe has all come together very neatly and very nicely in this very organized sense, you know, and this sense of arising. It's so interesting to be able to sense those moments in our day, not of chaos, but where everything hasn't been knitted together through perception, association, and clinging. You know, when we can allow, not for disorganization, not for chaos, but when we can allow for a life that is fluid, unfolding, uncertain, unpinned down, that kind of life of not knowing. And I see so much of meditative practice being this process of moving from these certainties, you know, about myself, about you, about who you are, about how life is, to move from all of these certainties which actually give us that sense of solidity and then even some semblance of safety, to a place of not knowing. And to move to that place of not knowing, it seems to me, is a process of emptying. Emptying the moment of clinging. Emptying the moment of selfing. Emptying the moment of view. Because I think more and more when we look carefully at our lives, we see that the only thing that really keeps anything fixed in place is my view of it. It not only, this is the way that we keep other people fixed in place, isn't it? When I can say, I know you, I actually know my view of you. This is the way that we keep ourselves fixed in place, isn't it? I know me. I know myself. Often, all that I know are my views, or sometimes more lethally, my judgments. Now, this process of perception and knowing our world, of course, can be in many times actually quite benign and quite neutral. Or it can be a process that is founded upon clinging. And all depends upon our understanding. Now, the Buddha speaks about the idea of self in three primary ways. The first way is called Sakaya Ditti. This is personality view. Personality view, or basically my changing views of who I am. The second way that the Buddha speaks about self, the Pali word for it is mana, which essentially translates as the conceit of self, or the ways that we position ourselves in relationship to the many selves that we encounter in our world. And the third way that the Buddha approaches this investigation is through understanding what is called in Pali shunya, or you may be more familiar with the word shunyata, which is usually translated as emptiness. Now, shunya emptiness is actually not that complicated, by the way. It simply means that just as it's impossible to find an independent self existence inwardly, it's also impossible to find that in anything. So shunyata is basically the expansion of the understanding of anatta or non-self into all things. So, and there's a wonderful, if I can find it, wonderful piece from Wei Ning, and he talks about this fluidity of non-self and emptiness. He says, "You must surely know emptiness is a perfect grass. This emptiness is bound to bloom like hundreds of grasses blooming. Seeing a dazzling variety of the flowers of emptiness, we surmise an infinity of the fruits of emptiness. We observe the bloom and fall of the flowers of emptiness and learn the spring and the autumn of them." Now, for the purposes of this evening's talk, I've discovered there's a problem here, by the way. This is a technical problem I'm hoping somebody is going to fix. You can't drink a glass of water with this thing. So for the purposes of this evening's talk, what I would really like to focus on are these two ways that the Buddha talks about selfing: the Sakaya Ditti, the personality view, and the mana, or the conceit of self. Since, in truth, the understanding of emptiness or shunya or shunyata is really quite the natural outcome of understanding personality view and mana, conceit. So personality view, I think this is quite self-evident myself, you know, and I cannot imagine why anybody wants to make this really very complicated, because, you know, you just need to close your eyes and look at your experience today, you know, and this is right on the table, right in front of you, okay? So, whereas mana, conceit of self, is a little bit more elusive and hidden. But okay, look a little bit at personality view, the view of self. Sakaya Ditti, how do you view yourself in this moment? And that's really a question of who are you right now? Just who are you right now? If you brought that kind of thoughtfulness inwardly, how would you view yourself? How would you describe yourself right now? What are the mechanisms you would do that? You would pull all these bits together, wouldn't you? Your emotions, your perceptions, your thoughts, your body experience. So you would say, you know, I'm bored, or I'm uncomfortable, or I'm confused, or I want to be out of here, or I want to stay forever, or I feel good, or I feel bad, I'm obsessing, I'm excited, I'm half asleep, and planning. This is Sakaya Ditti. This is personality view. It is view of self. Now, some of these personality views, of course, can be pretty intense, and sometimes they're quiet murmurings. You know, they, when we're kind of floating through our day and there's no big crisis, you know, and no huge demands and no big unskillful mental states or emotions, Sakaya Ditti is pretty subdued. In fact, there may be many, many moments when you're not even aware of it. But there's other moments when it's pretty intense. Now, you cast your mind back just a few hours ago from right now, and has your view of self changed in those hours? Now cast your mind back even further and remember all the views of self. You know, I've just spent 5 days with my elderly parents, you know, and they have a whole story about me that I hardly even recognize. You know, I certainly hardly remember it, and I can't figure out whether I'm suffering from amnesia or whether they're just making it up. You know, but I can hardly even recognize it. But it's sort of casting your mind back and remembering all of the houses we've inhabited. As a child, as a teenager, do you remember your view of self in your first relationship? Do you remember your view of self in your first breakup? Your view of self as a student or as a parent? All the changing faces, all the changing identities in our lives. And remember, too, sometimes how really substantial those houses felt. Do you remember having those thoughts, you know, I'm always going to feel like this? I'm going to be forlorn forever? You know, I'm always going to be incompetent? Or somebody tells you you're always going to be something? And, you know, I'm always going to be in love, or I'm always going to be anxious. This is how and who I am. And what we really get a sense of is that the degree of substantiality of our houses is entirely related to the intensity of the clinging and the identification in those moments. So sometimes our houses are kind of like flimsy shacks, aren't they? And sometimes our houses are like moated castles. You know, and sometimes we're living in the houses that are kind of flimsy shacks, and the wind blows through, and we feel that the chatter of the sort of views of self kind of arriving and passing, and they're mostly kind of reactive patterns, aren't they? You can sort of feel self as a reflex. Selfing as a reflex, you know, a sound, a sight, an impression, you know, an encounter, and you feel that kind of reflex of selfing. And then its foundations are kind of weak, you know, because maybe it's rooted in a mood at the moment or some passing encounter. So the foundations of that house are pretty flimsy. And, you know, sometimes actually there's even enough mindfulness to know what's going on. And that makes those foundations even more flimsy. So those views and self, they kind of change. They it's not so difficult to empty. And then sometimes we're really in the moated castles, you know, and we really have that belief, this is who I am. You know, underneath all the other passing changes, this is really who I am. And this is going to last forever. The views are historical, they're repetitive, they're familiar. Sometimes the views have been told to us by others. I remember a couple of months ago, I was in my local post office, and I was approaching the cash register just as a young woman was approaching the cash register from the other direction. You know, and I could see, you know, she was actually ahead of me. You know, so I waited, and I said, you know, like, go ahead, you know, you were here first. And she looked at me, and she said, that's amazing. I said, what's amazing? She said, I'm the kind of person that people always push in front of in queues. She said it with such certainty that I'm the kind of person that people always push in front of in queues. And I could sort of feel my heart sink, you know, to go through life with that kind of definition, that I'm this kind of person that this always happens to. You know, it sounds like a kind of prison. It sounds like a sadness, a tremendous sadness. And, you know, maybe it sounds implausible, and yet many of our personality views actually are pretty solid, aren't they? They're the returning ones, you know, the frequent visitors. You know, some come and go, and then you get the return visitors. You know, I'm going to be always like the kid on the beach who gets sand kicked in their face, or, you know, I'm always going to be the pessimist, I'm always shy, or I'm always extroverted. I will never be happy. I will never be successful or adequate. Notice what clinging intensifies around. I mean, there's an awful lot of research that tells us the way that the mind is so biased to lean towards what is broken and what is imperfect and what is unacceptable. That the mind is so biased, hardwired to lean towards what is wrong. Okay? And where does clinging intensify? It very rarely intensifies or solidifies around the skillful and the wholesome. Have you noticed that? I am such a calm person, you know. I mean, that sounds far less plausible than, oh, I'm so agitated. You know, and the kind of the emotional weight around that. The clinging often intensifies around what we can't accept, what we feel fearful of or aversive to. It intensifies with what we perceive to be imperfect, and clinging intensifies around what we feel to be missing, what we crave for and what we long for. Now, some of these return visitors, these repetitive views, personality views, they become patterns and tendencies in themselves. So I have a pattern of selfing. And that pattern of selfing, of course, is the pattern that I use to pattern the world around me and to pattern you. To pattern you. You know, if I feel to be a very anxious person, if that's my personality view, I will pattern you with that selfing. I will see you as being slightly threatening. You know, someone to be anxious about. So the body is perceived as one of the building blocks of self, feeling, perceptions, volitions, consciousness, perceived or seen to be the building blocks of the self of the moment. I am the owner of, defined by all of this. And selfing is a process. I mean, in Buddhist psychology, you know, there's a very clear sense of continuum, that craving and aversion intensify into clinging, and clinging intensifies into becoming the I am. These are not separate events or separate experiences. These are energetic continuums. You know, and perhaps you see that in your own experience, the way that aversion, when it is dwelt upon, deepens, solidifies, turns to clinging, and turns to that arrival of I am or you are. So too does craving. These are all continuums. They are processes. And with mindfulness, we do learn to be more present in the process. And we begin to see that if we can calm a little bit those impulses of craving and aversion, we learn we can calm a little bit those impulses of clinging, and this is to calm the selfing. Now, the power of this patterning, the power of personality view forming, I would say, is entirely related, reliant upon the absence of mindfulness and investigation. You know, so it's not like some people are lucky and have less personality view and reification than others, and others are unlucky. You know, this entirely relies, the process of selfing and centralizing relies upon the absence of mindfulness and investigation, which is good news. Because these are qualities that we can all cultivate. These are qualities we can all remind ourselves of. As we cultivate more mindfulness, more kindness, more curiosity, the qualities available to us, we see more and more the transparency of our views, and we see that the self is not a noun, it is not an entity, it is not an essence, it is a process. And it is clearly not independence. In fact, selfing is a verb. Selfing is a verb. Now, the introduction of clinging turns process into state, and it turns verb into noun. And we begin to sense that in our own experience and understanding. Now, the I am is not independent. The view of ourselves in the moment is shaped by our interactions with others. It's shaped by the world of events and how we engage with them. The sense doors, the sights, the sounds. We are not only interacting with the world around us, we are reacting to the world around us. Welcoming and rejecting, liking, disliking, fearing, wanting. And if all of this is unseen, it gets magnified into clinging and shapes self-view. And that shaping of self-view, as I mentioned, shapes the view of the other and creates the other. Creates the other. Sometimes the other is external and sometimes the other is internal in our own body-mind experience. That which we're reacting to through craving and aversion. It is, language is difficult, you know, the English language is difficult because there's this endless suggestion of autonomy, isn't there, in the English language, you know, I want this, I do this, I don't do this, I need this, you know, I should let go of this. There's this endless suggestion of autonomy just in our grammatical structures. And so we have this idea that it's me doing all of this. You know, that I'm craving, I'm aversive, I'm clinging. We have this very strange idea. But in reality, what we see, sight, sense, sensations are happening. And the world of conditions, we have never been able to control it, and we think we should be able to. And that's where our grammatical structures get tied up with view, isn't there? I want to be able to control this, and my language is telling me I really should be able to do it. But that, again, is coming back to the question of who reigns the rain and who thunders the thunder. Life is this interface of process and conditions. Sometimes that process is happening on the ground of understanding, and it can be sorrowful, it can be sad, it can be delightful, but it is not the basis of clinging. And sometimes this interface of process and conditions is happening on the ground of confusion. And then there's plenty of room there for lots of suffering and distress. And the ground upon which process and conditions is happening is actually in our hands. I don't cling. Clinging is what happens when craving and aversion are fed. I also don't let go. What is in my hands is the cultivation of the conditions of stillness and calmness and investigation in which letting go happens, and I invite you to really look at that in your own experience. that sometimes you're sitting or you're just living, and the mind and the heart can feel so sticky and so contracted or so aversive, you know, and a sight comes along or a difficult thought comes around along, and you just feel the contraction and the clinging around it. Other times, you know, the mind, the heart can feel quite spacious, can be a lot of calm, a lot of ease. Exactly the same sight or exactly the same thought can come along and just passes right on through, doesn't it? There's no stickiness and the content hasn't changed. What has really changed, of course, is the climate of heart in which that content is appearing. And this, of course, is what is in our hands. The Buddha put it, when no view of self is clung to, no view at all is clung to. And that this is the end of fear and pursuit and avoidance and contractedness. This is peace and this is liberation. Now, the second way that the view of self is reified is, as I mentioned, through mana. And this is a very awkward translation. You know, it's not a very good translation of this word, mana. It's usually translated as conceit of self. But it's basically the way that I position myself in relationship to you as being better than you, worse than you, or simply the same as you. Now, this sounds very, very, very benign, doesn't it? It sounds like not really a problem. In fact, mana is one of the most powerful conditioning forces in human consciousness. If I see myself as being less or inferior, less able than you, less confident than you, less adequate, less lovable than others, be aware of how much we go through life comparing ourselves to other people. Huh? This is mana in action. You know, this is the conceit of self in action. You know, and I might see myself in that way being so much less capable, or I see myself being better, smarter, you know, more knowledgeable than you, or else I see us basically we're all the same, you know, we're just a bunch of nutheads trying to muddle our way through life and condemned to a kind of shared mediocrity. Now, mana is very hidden. It's kind of very hidden, but it has a very powerful impact upon everything, upon our speech, our actions, our intentions, what we believe to be impossible for us, where we sit in the hall, whether we ask a question or don't ask a question, how we view the world, how we view the other people, what we aspire to or what we resign ourselves to. It's the story about ourselves, and sometimes mana is the story that's told to us by others throughout our life, isn't it? You know, I have a little great nephew, he's 5 years old. The whole family's decided he's stupid. Well, you know, he might turn out stupid. You know, if everybody tells you you're stupid, why would you ever be any different? It shapes our sense of possibility, how we approach this path, whether we approach our practice striving to be the next Buddha or thinking it's a fairly lucky accident if we even manage to run into a breath. So, mana, and I hope you can kind of naturalize this word because it's such a mouthful to keep saying conceit of self. It's an interactive view, and you have to think about how mana and personality view are shaping each other. You know, if I have this underlying, often unarticulated belief in my inferiority, how is that going to shape how personality view is shaped in the moment? Aren't I constantly going to be hypervigilant, like to criticism or blame? Feel it, I deserve it? Am I going to find myself unable to offer kindness or generosity inwardly because basically I don't deserve it? So personality view and mana are constantly going to be interfacing with one another. If I fall asleep on the cushion, I will wake up and say, oh, I know I fell asleep on the cushion because I always feel, you know, because I'm such a schmuck. You know, and I'm such a hopeless meditator. So mana and personality view are constantly shaping one another. If I believe myself to be superior, better than you, what am I going to do? I'm going to be always highlighting your imperfections because that's going to confirm my position of being somehow better. I'm going to be impatient. I'm going to be striving. I'm going to need to assert myself. So that underlying mana or conceit is going to be shaping my personality view of the moment. What is, I think, so important to see in this whole prison of selfing is that mana and sakkaya ditti are the saboteurs of everything that is liberating. And they're particularly the saboteurs of the Brahma-viharas, of kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity. Because you can think about it, you know, if I really feel myself somehow to be better or worse than you, there's not a lot of room for befriending. Might have pity, but not so much compassion. You know, joy is going to be difficult in those places of defensiveness. And I'm going to be so easily knocked off balance. The Brahma-viharas, these kind of ennobling qualities of the heart, they really rest upon softening and dissolving this reification, both of self and other. Because this reification breeds division, it breeds fear, it breeds conflict. And it breeds craving, because the strange thing about personality view and mana is that in some ways it's always broken. It's never enough. You know, there's always the belief in never quite having the perfect me. So what is the work of this path? Well, it's certainly not to annihilate self. It's certainly not to shout at ourselves to let go. This is a path of cultivating moment to moment the spacious awareness, the inner kindness, the stillness that really allows the transparency of selfing to be seen, that allows the clinging to fade, that allows the craving and aversion to fall away. When the Buddha extolled the virtues of homelessness, he wasn't just talking about a lifestyle. He was talking about a way of inhabiting this life in which we're not always engaged in this process of house building. You know, when we think about, if we think about the work of this path or the aspiration of this path, is to really look to the moment and the possibilities of emptying the moment of selfing. And in a way, this is the greatest gift to ourselves, because this is what allows others, allows ourselves, really to be the fluid, the unfolding, the changing beings that we are, with all the possibilities that are rooted in that fluidity. The Buddha suggested there is a way of being in this way, in this world, not inhabiting any house that is built on clinging. And he said it, this is the state of peace. This is the awakened heart. Okay, thank you. Thank you for your attention. So, you might want to take... I'm sure you want to take 5 minutes to stand up and stretch, and then we've got some time if there's anything you want to raise for some reflection or questions. Okay, so the question is about this. I mentioned the three positions of mana. One is being inferior to others, one is being superior to others, and the third is being the same as others, which I wouldn't use the word equal interchangeably with the same. Because I think what the Buddha is suggesting in this is this is a kind of resignation and a kind of a surrender of a sense of possibility both in others and myself. It's a kind of like the lowest possible denominator in human beings. You know, and there's a reassurance in it. We all do that. You know, you've heard that. We all do that. You know, it's kind of reassuring, you know, if I find myself being completely mindless and heedless, you know, it's kind of nice to look around and say, oh, well, we all do that, you know, and sometimes I hear this, you know, I hear people say it and I think, oh, well, we all have hidden ulterior motives, you know, and I sort of think, no, I don't think that's true, you know, but there's a kind of reassurance and a sense of, if I actually have this sense of sameness, and I usually base that sense of sameness not on the greatest in human beings, but in the least perfect, you know, it kind of excuses me, doesn't it? It's sort of an opt-out clause. Like, I don't have to make any effort, really, because we all do this. We're all the same. You know, and I find there's a certain, I think the Buddha suggests there's a certain kind of cynicism in it. You know, it's a kind of just that surrender of possibility, and it's almost kind of like the blinkers go on to actually be able to admire or esteem someone as an example to aspire to. You know, if I give you an example of this, I remember some years ago when Al Gore put out his documentary on An Inconvenient Truth. Immediately, there were all these kind of people who were publishing, you know, his electricity usage every month, not mentioning that it was produced by solar energy and whatever. But this need to actually bring him down, because we can't allow anybody to, you know, have any kind of sense of greatness. You know, we have to be suspicious of it, because otherwise what are we going to do with that information? You know, either we would have to kind of raise our game or, you know, re-examine our own aspirations. But it's easier to bring everybody down to the least possible, lowest possible denominator. And in some ways, you know, that kind of sameness belief, I think, is almost more lethal than the inferiority and superiority beliefs. Because it's the one in which, you know, there's the greatest need to almost keep the safety of it, but doesn't allow any saints in our lives. And I'm not using that cynically, but it doesn't allow us to have anything or anyone that we admire or aspire to. It's almost the end of the path, actually.
I'm struck, really strong emotion for like anger or greed or something. I'm struck how they sort of, it feels like it happens before the yogi ever seems to sort of catch it. Can you talk a little bit more about how that, because you've sort of talked tonight about, maybe I think from a different angle, but just how one can, is it really possible to see it the whole way through, like a really strong emotion? Or do you really experience it and then you get a chance to come back and that's what happened and understand?
Do everyone hear the question? Okay, is it possible to actually track a strong emotion like anger or greed from its beginning? Or is it more likely to be retrospective, that, you know, we get caught up in a storm of greed or a storm of aversion, and afterwards kind of re-examine it or reflect upon it or investigate upon it? Yes, it is entirely possible, but something differs. if there is, you see, the problem, I mean, the basic equation here is that mindfulness and habit do not coexist. Okay. Now, sometimes there's differing degrees of mindfulness and differing degrees of habit, isn't there? I mean, sometimes there's like a wee bit of mindfulness and a big dose of habit. And in that case, we have a lot of what's often referred to as conscious incompetence. We know what we're doing and we do it anyway. Sometimes we also see there's far more awareness and there's a lot that comes with awareness, with mindfulness. And the habit may arise, but it's got no fuel to continue. So it's not tracking a strong emotion. No, we do not track strong emotions all the way through, because if there is sufficient awareness and investigation and all of the family of mindfulness there in the arising of greed and aversion, they do not become strong emotions that need tracking through, because there's no fuel for that strengthening. So I think that's kind of it. No, we don't. Because, you know, if the strength of the emotions is there to such an degree that there's no presence of mindfulness or curiosity, then there's no restraining factor, and we will have retrospective awareness. And so I think it's really useful, actually. I think it's a good question, because I think it's really useful to look at the difference in the times when we have primarily retrospective awareness or mindfulness, when we're looking back on something that happened with, usually with some form of regret. Or the times when actually we haven't ended up in that place, that we've got something to look back on. And again, it's really a question of what is the difference in those times, you know. And, you know, I find of late, you know, I kind of lost, I think we get fooled by the word meditation, personally. You know, this is a word that was borrowed from the Gospels, which is a good word. It's a good word, you know, but it means something different than what is pointed out to in the discourses, which is bhavana, which is cultivation, bringing to being. So I think we have a very different sense of being a cultivator than being a meditator. You know, and if we're definitely engaged in cultivating, this is not something reserved for eyes closed. You know, whereas meditation is much more reserved for eyes closed times. Cultivation is concerned with all times, eyes closed, eyes open. So it's concerned really with cultivating the qualities that really rescue us from retrospective awareness. You know, and then I think there's an investigation. What are the qualities that rescue us from retrospective awareness? You know, and it has a lot to do with the cultivation of, you know, a present moment recollection, mindfulness established in body. Restraint is a big one. The willingness to cultivate restraint, the willingness to cultivate wholesome qualities. You know, the kindness, the compassion, the joy, the equanimity, the spaciousness, because they're mostly the qualities that do the job of letting go and of calming the unwholesome. So, you know, I think it's a big question, you know, what is it that rescues us from retrospective awareness? It's a really useful investigation. I mean, not that retrospective awareness is terrible, but it's not where we want to live. You know, because that's often a life of regret. Those two together. So the question is, if shunyata was really understood, would emotion still arise? Okay.
Right.
So how are you putting those two together? I mean, what is the discomfort in the back of your mind? You would it mean that shunyata would render things meaningless, or
no? Not to react. I mean, the emotion is still going to arise, even if you have emptiness or not to react to things. Am I understanding that?
Well, I think it's just it's a complex question. I mean, first of all, recognizing that emotion does not exist as a word in Pali, okay? So there we have a starting point, right? There's no word for emotion in Pali. Okay, and yet very clearly the Buddha and the monks and nuns and lay people around him were very clearly responsive, feeling, living, dynamic, engaged human beings, you know. So the way that emotion doesn't respond in Pali, because emotion, from the perspective of Buddhist psychology, is a combo experience. It's a constructed experience. It involves body sensation, it involves vedana, involves thought, involves association, involves interface with the world. So there are wholesome constructions and there's less wholesome ones. Okay? So understanding shunyata is basically pulling the rug out from underneath all unwholesome reactions. Okay? Because if I think of my unwholesome or unskillful reactions of greed or aversion or ill will, they're pretty much all rooted in reifying the other. Okay? So when I think of all the wholesome or the skillful responses and constructions I can have of celebration, of joy, of gladness, of delight, of compassion, of empathy, as far as I can see, these arise in the moments when reification is least perceptible. Does that answer your question? So in a way, I think, you know, understanding the emptiness of centrality in anything is pretty much the open door to really that flowering of those skillful feelings, emotions, responses. Because I think that the reification, the solidification, the investing of self in all things really lays the ground for feelings of insufficiency, need, inadequacy, ill will, threat, all the rest of it. Yes, sir. Reification is investing in an independent self into things and solidifying them. Okay? So the question was about reification. What are we about reifying? It's making something solid, making something real out of something that is process and fluid. From one which?
From one incarnation to another.
Oh, that's a big question. I think that's one of the questions the Buddha says you shouldn't even ask. I mean, no, the reason why, well, first of all, reincarnation is not a Buddhist teaching, okay? This is a Hindu teaching. The idea of rebirth is a constantly debated discussion in all fields of Dharma. It's never been promoted as something to take on as a belief system, but as an investigation. That you will find Buddhist schools that will talk about past lives, present lives, and future lives. You will see Buddhist teachings and teachers who entirely see that teaching on rebirth as being a present moment, moment-to-moment experience, okay, that has nothing to do with past and future. I think in terms of practical purposes, I think the most useful way of looking at rebirth in my experience is to look at how this is happening on a moment-to-moment level. And it's really, it's so clearly, I think, laid out in most of the Buddha's core teachings, and particularly in the teaching of dependent arising, which is the teaching of how our world is being constructed moment to moment and then changing into a different world. And the Buddha really invited us to look into our own minds and our own experience and to actually examine whether that is true for us. So he started with a very simple, it seems very simple formula, that what we contact, we feel. What we feel, we dwell upon. What we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. The shape of our mind becomes who I am. And who I am becomes the shape of my world. Sometimes the formula differs slightly. It becomes contact, feeling, craving and aversion, clinging, becoming, and birth. And the birth is a sense of reaching that place of I am that lasts only until that particular formation of clinging remains, and it's usually knocked off the shelf by another moment of contact. Now, personally, I think if we look at the idea of a continuous self, what we see is that sense of I am and that sense of birth happening 1,000 times in a single day. And what gives the impression of continuity is clinging. So, you know, personally my own suggestion would be is rather that, you know, because I don't think the Buddha was much into metaphysics, actually. I really do think the Buddha was quite pragmatic. You know, that he didn't actually teach things that people really couldn't examine in their own experience, because, you know, as far as he was concerned, this is where suffering was born and this is where suffering ends within our own experience. So personally, my own suggestion would be rather than to move into the metaphysics, to move into the practical, you know, and actually how do I see this? How do I experience this? Can I experience this in my present moment experience? Because if I can't, it's not a lot of use. You know, it's not much help. And so to look at that idea of how self is born, and then, you know, in the continuation of that formula from birth is followed by death, but it's almost like the death or the changing of that self of the moment. Yes. That you're... Oh, that you're being co-opted into their view of self. So how do you compassionately engage with people who are co-opting you into their particular mana scenario, which happens a great deal? You know, someone says to us, oh, you're so amazing, I could never do that. You know, or someone says, you know, why can't you ever do what I do? It's the reverse of that, you know. Or look at us, we're all so hopeless. You know, none of us can actually do this. I mean, it is a difficult one. A lot of our capacity to question, You know, because we are relational beings, so we're endlessly being co-opted into each other's views, aren't we? And we almost want to co-opt people into our view because it helps us to be who we think we are. So doesn't a lot of that depend on the quality of that relationship? You know, I mean, if it's just a sort of passing relationship, you know, and without a lot of depth or trust, you know, it's probably not a great deal you can do. You know, but, you know, say you go home for Thanksgiving, you know, and you know, you meet up with family members, you know, who are desperate to co-opt you into their view of self. You know, oh, God, you're the one who was always so annoying, you know, and you're still really... there's some depth of relationship there, we hope. And those are the places where we can perhaps discuss it more as a curiosity, as an investigation, you know, not as quit doing that to me, you know, I'm not that person anymore. But there maybe we have that possibility of discussing it as a joint investigation. Oh, look what I do to you, and this is how, you know, how I hear this, and why, you know, what that means for you. But with the passing ones, there's hardly anything that you cannot take responsibility for another person's mind, can you? I mean, only if there's a willingness to engage is something possible. And, you know, maybe the compassion is recognizing sometimes that willingness is not there. I think that's about the end of our evening. I really do thank you for your attention. Thank you. Please travel home safely.